Throughout, the legal arguments keep to a principle enunciated by the distinguished Israeli statesman Abba Iban. In determining the legal basis for some intended action, one might work backward from the action one wished to take to find a legal justification. The script has been followed fairly closely, as much the same elements gained a hold on political power in the 2000 election. In 1981, they had combined a vast increase in military spending with tax cuts, calculating that growing hysteria over the ensuing deficit would create powerful pressures to cut federal social spending, and thus, perhaps, enable the administration to accomplish its goal of rolling back the New Deal. George W. Bush followed the pattern with tax cuts overwhelmingly benefiting the very rich, and the biggest surge in federal spending in 20 years, largely military, hence indirectly high-tech industry. Government deficits require fiscal discipline, which translates into cutbacks for services for the general population. The administration's own economists estimate the bills that the government will be unable to pay at $44 trillion. Their study was to be included in the annual budget report published in February 2003, but was removed, perhaps because it forecast that closing the gap would require a huge tax increase, and Bush was trying to ram through another tax reduction, again benefiting mainly the rich. President Bush is working overtime to deepen our fiscal trap, economists Lawrence Kotlikoff and Jeffrey Sachs observe, reporting the enormous anticipated fiscal gap. Among the results, they contend, will be massive cuts in future Social Security and Medicare benefits. White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer agreed with the $44 trillion estimate and implicitly conceded the accuracy of the analysis as well. There is no question that Social Security and Medicare are going to present future generations with a crushing debt burden unless policymakers work seriously to reform those programs, which does not mean funding them by progressive taxation. The problem is deepened by the serious financial crisis of states and cities. The editors of the staid Financial Times are only stating the obvious, economist Paul Krugman comments, when they write that the more extreme Republicans with their hands on the controls seem to want a fiscal train wreck that offers the tantalizing prospect of forcing cuts on social programs through the back door. Slated for demolition, Krugman contends, are Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. But the same may be true for the whole range of programs of the past century that were developed to protect the population from the ravages of private power. Eliminating social programs has goals that go well beyond concentration of wealth and power. Social Security, public schools, and other such deviations from the right way that U.S. military power is to impose on the world, as frankly declared, are based on evil doctrines, among them the pernicious belief that we should care, as a community, whether the disabled widow on the other side of town can make it through the day, or the child next door should have a chance for a decent future. These evil doctrines derive from the principle of sympathy that was taken to be the core of human nature by Adam Smith and David Hume, a principle that must be driven from the mind. Privatization has other benefits. If working people depend on the stock market for their pensions, health care, and other means of survival, they have a stake in undermining their own interests, opposing wage increases, health and safety regulations, and other measures that might cut into profits that flow to the benefactors on whom they must rely in a manner reminiscent of feudalism. After a surge of presidential popularity following 9/11, polls revealed increasing discontent with the social and economic policies of the administration. If there was to be any hope of maintaining political power, the Bush forces were virtually compelled to adopt what Anatole Levin calls the classic modern strategy of an endangered right-wing oligarchy, which is to divert mass discontent into nationalism, a strategy which is second nature to them in any event, having worked so well during their first 12 years in office. The strategy was outlined by Karl Rove, the chief political advisor. Republicans must go to the country on the issue of national security in November 2002 because voters trust the Republican Party for protecting America. Similarly, he explained, Bush will have to be portrayed as a wartime leader for the 2004 presidential campaign. As long as domestic issues were dominating news coverage and political battles over the summer, Bush and his Republicans lost ground, the chief international analyst for UPI pointed out. But the imminent threat of Iraq was conjured up just in time in September 2002. Recognizing its vulnerability on domestic issues, the administration is campaigning to sustain and increase its power on a policy of international adventurism, new radical preemptive military strategies, and a hunger for a politically convenient and perfectly timed confrontation with Iraq. For the midterm electoral campaign, the tactic worked. Just. Even though voters believe that Republicans are more concerned about large corporations than about ordinary Americans, they trust the Republicans on national security. In September, the national security strategy was announced. manufactured fear provided enough of a popular base for the invasion of Iraq, instituting the new norm of aggressive war at will, and afforded the administration enough of a hold on political power so that it could proceed with a harsh and unpopular domestic agenda. Again, the script for the first tenure in power is being followed closely, though now with greater fervor, fewer external constraints, and considerably greater threats to peace. Insignificant risks. The war with Iraq was undertaken with the recognition that it might well lead to proliferation of WMD and terror, risks considered insignificant compared with the prospect of gaining control over Iraq, firmly establishing the norm of preventive war, and strengthening the hold on domestic power. Evidence as to how seriously real security threats ranked on the priority list was provided immediately after the announcement of the Imperial Grand Strategy on September 17, 2002. The administration at once publicly abandoned an international effort to strengthen the Biological Weapons Convention against germ warfare, advising allies that further discussions would have to be delayed for 4 years. As noted, in mid-October, it was learned that during an earlier episode of Playing with Fire, the world was brought ominously close to nuclear war. 10 days later, on October 23rd, the UN Disarmament Committee adopted two crucial resolutions. The first called for stronger measures to prevent the militarization of space and thereby to avert a grave danger for international peace and security. The second reaffirmed the 1925 Geneva Protocol, prohibiting the use of poisonous gases and bacteriological methods of warfare. Both passed unanimously, with two abstentions, the U.S. and Israel. U.S. abstention amounts to a veto, typically a double veto, banning the events from reporting and history. In the mainstream media, there was no mention of these failed attempts by the rest of the world to prevent serious threats to survival. The meager press coverage of the startling revelations at the Havana retrospective in October 2002 had little to say about the highly topical issues of international terrorism and forceful regime change, or about the Iraq connection, which was very much in the minds of the participants. On their way to Havana, they had surely read the letter sent by CIA Director George Tenet to the Senate Intelligence Committee Chair, Senator Bob Graham, reporting that although there was little likelihood that Saddam would initiate a terrorist operation with conventional weapons or any chemical or biological weapons he might have, the probability would rise to pretty high in the event of U.S. attack. The FBI also reported concerns that a war with Iraq could trigger new domestic terrorism risks, as did the head of Homeland Security. The leading international military intelligence journal and allied intelligence agencies drew the same conclusions, adding the further observation that a U.S. attack could globalize anti-American and anti-Western sentiment. Attacking Iraq would intensify Islamic terrorism, not reduce it. A war in Iraq threatens to fuel unrest and create new terrorist threats, European security and police officials are warning their governments, recruiting new young people to the ever-growing anti-U.S. stand. Concurring, Richard Betts, a specialist on surprise attack and nuclear blackmail, wrote that in the event of a U.S. invasion, Saddam will have no reason to withhold his best parting shot, which could be the use of WMD inside the United States. That is, activating networks already in place. The odds may be low, he observed, perhaps as low as what took place on 9/11. Those who have any concern for the safety and security of the people of the United States and other likely targets would not, of course, dismiss the odds as negligible. Mainstream experts agreed that an attack by the most powerful military force in history against a defenseless enemy might well stimulate the quest for revenge or deterrence. Prominent international relations scholars have pointed out that potential targets of U.S. adventurism know that the United States can be held at bay only by deterrence, primarily by WMD. In this way, American policies stimulate the vertical proliferation of nuclear weapons and promote their spreading from one country to another. The same policies stimulate terrorism. Unsurprisingly, weak states and disaffected people lash out at the United States as the agent or symbol of their suffering, and if no efforts are made to address their grievances, they are likely to react with the means available to them, including terror. U.S. intelligence added that the deepening economic stagnation caused by Washington's version of globalization was likely to have similar effects. These warnings were not new. It had been recognized for some time that the industrial powers were likely to lose their virtual monopoly of violence, retaining only an enormous preponderance. Well before 9/11, technical studies had concluded that a well-planned operation to smuggle WMD into the United States would have at least a 90% probability of success. This has become America's Achilles heel, a study with that title concluded, reviewing the many options available to terrorists. The Council on Foreign Relations Task Force study adds others. The imminence of the danger was evident after the 1993 attempt to blow up the World Trade Center, which, with better planning, might have killed tens of thousands of people, the World Trade Center building engineers reported. It was also anticipated that an attack on Iraq might stimulate proliferation in more direct ways. Terrorism specialist Daniel Benjamin, no dove, observed that an invasion might cause the greatest proliferation disaster in history. Saddam Hussein had proven himself to be a brutal tyrant, but a rational one. If he had chemical and biological weapons, they were kept under tight control and subject to a proper chain of command. He would surely not put them in the hands of the Osama bin Ladens of the world, a terrible threat to Saddam himself. But under attack, Iraqi society might collapse, and with it the controls over WMD, which might be offered to the huge market for unconventional weapons, a nightmare scenario from every point of view. Post-war investigation reveals that Benjamin's concerns may have been realized with the looting of nuclear sites. This pre-war establishment critique had a number of important features. First, it echoed concerns in the same circles about the posture of a rogue superpower that much of the world regards as the greatest threat to world peace and the single greatest external threat to their societies. Second, it encompassed an unusually broad spectrum of voices. The comments cited above come from U.S. and world intelligence agencies, the world's leading military journal, the January 2003 issue of the two major national foreign policy journals, an unusual publication of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, some of the most respected specialists on international affairs, terrorism, and strategic analysis, and even the Wizards of Davos, who dominate the world's economy. Whatever one thinks of their judgments, it would not be easy to find a historical precedent for such a critique of a planned war, just as there was no precedent at all for popular opposition to a war prior to its being officially launched. Third, though this critique originated in the establishment, it was ignored. The administration made no effort to counter it, indeed hardly seemed to notice it, which makes sense. From a propaganda point of view, the most powerful state in history needs no justification or serious argument for its actions. Declaration of noble intent should suffice. Just as the UN is informed that it can be relevant and authorize what we are going to do or suffer the consequences, so the world should be put on notice that the hegemonic power bears no burden of proof for its resort to violence or any other action. It would be a derogation of authority to acknowledge, let alone refute, critical noises, to borrow McGeorge Bundy's derisive phrase. The critics are right that the superpower stance might lead to self-destruction, but such concerns have commonly not been a high priority of leaders. In the present case, the administration was surely aware, even without warnings from respected authorities, that its planned war against Iraq and other related actions were likely to increase the risks of proliferation of WMD and terror against the U.S. and its allies. But evidently, it assigns low priority to such threats compared with other goals. Furthermore, though planners of course do not welcome the proliferation of WMD and terrorism, they know that they can exploit such developments for their own purposes, both global and domestic. Even the fear they elicit throughout the world is quite acceptable. They are not trying to be loved, but obeyed. And if this is achieved by fear, that is fine, another contribution to maintaining credibility. As for the goals, senior Middle East correspondent and analyst Yusuf Ibrahim was no doubt oversimplifying when he identified them as bolstering the president's popularity for short-term political gain and turning a friendly Iraq into a private American oil pumping station. But there is good reason to believe that his observations at least point in the right direction. Maintaining a hold on political power and enhancing U.S. control of the world's primary energy sources are major steps toward the twin goals that have been declared with considerable clarity: to institutionalize a radical restructuring of domestic society that will roll back the progressive reforms of a century, and to establish an imperial grand strategy of permanent world domination. Compared with such ends, the risks may well seem insignificant. The wild men in the wings. Establishment critics and the White House tended to focus on the same issues as the Security Council debates and the inspections: the Iraqi threat, WMD, and the subcategory of terror that enters the canon. None of the debates gave more than a passing nod to democratization or liberation or any other issues that lie beyond the potential threat to the U.S. and its allies. There was little discussion, for example, of the possible effects of war on the population of Iraq, except among the wild men in the wings, to borrow the term used by McGeorge Bundy to refer to those who felt that more was involved in the Vietnam War than military success and its cost to the invaders. As Washington marched resolutely to war against Iraq, the wild men and women were again looking beyond the narrow question of the costs to themselves. With the Iraqi people at the edge of survival after a decade of destructive sanctions, international aid and medical agencies warned that a war might lead to a serious humanitarian catastrophe. Switzerland hosted a meeting of 30 countries to prepare for what might lie ahead. The U.S. alone refused to attend. Participants, including the other four permanent Security Council members, warned of devastating humanitarian consequences of a war. Former Assistant Secretary of Defense Kenneth Bacon, head of the Washington-based Refugees International, predicted that a war will generate huge flows of refugees and a public health crisis. Meanwhile, U.S. plans for humanitarian relief in a post-war Iraq were criticized by international aid agencies as short on detail, woefully lacking in money, and overly controlled by the military. UN officials complained, "There is a studied lack of interest in Washington in a warning call we are trying to deliver to the people planning for war about what its consequences might be." Horrifying and brutal as Saddam Hussein's regime was, he nevertheless did direct oil profits to internal development. A tyrant, at the head of a regime that has turned violence into an instrument of state, with a hideous human rights record, he nevertheless had hoisted half the country's population into the middle class, and Arabs the world over came to study at Iraqi universities. The 1991 war, involving the purposeful destruction of water, power, and sewage systems, took a terrible toll, and the sanctions regime imposed by the U.S. and U.K. drove the country to the level of bare survival. As one illustration, UNICEF's 2003 report on the state of the world's children states that Iraq's regression over the past decade is by far the most severe of the 193 countries surveyed, with the child death rate, the best single indicator of child welfare, increasing from 50 to 133 per 1,000 live births, placing Iraq below every country outside Africa, apart from Cambodia and Afghanistan. Two hawkish military analysts observe that economic sanctions may well have been a necessary cause of the deaths of more people in Iraq than have been slain by all so-called weapons of mass destruction throughout history, in the hundreds of thousands, according to conservative estimates. No Westerners know Iraq better than Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck, the respected UN diplomats who were the chief UN humanitarian coordinators, with an international staff of hundreds of investigators traveling daily through the country. Both resigned in protest at what Halliday described as the genocidal character of the US-UK sanctions regime. Both reject claims that food and medicine were being withheld by the authorities. Their successor, Tun Miat, backed their view, describing the Iraqi system as the best distribution system that he had ever seen in his life as a World Food Program official. The senior UN World Food Program, WFP, official reported that the WFP had conducted more than a million inspections of the system and uncovered no significant evidence of fraud or favoritism. He added that there was no way we could create something else that would work half as well as the Iraqi system, which is the most efficient in the world, and that the risk of a large-scale humanitarian crisis would increase if anything happened to disrupt it. As Halliday, von Sponeck, and others had pointed out for years, the sanctions devastated the population while strengthening Saddam Hussein and his clique, also increasing the dependency of the Iraqi people on the tyrant for their survival. Von Sponeck, who resigned in 2000, reported that the U.S. and U.K. systematically tried to prevent him and Halliday from briefing the Security Council, because they didn't want to hear what we had to say about the savagery of the sanctions. The U.S. media apparently agree. Though the expert knowledge of the U.N. coordinators is without parallel, Americans have had to turn elsewhere to hear what they had to say, even at a moment of laser-like fixation on Iraq. Discussion of the effects of the sanctions has been minimal and apologetic, the usual procedure with regard to the crimes of one's own state. Academic researcher Joy Gordon found that even the information that does reach the Security Council is kept from public scrutiny, though she learned enough, as have others, to reveal a shameful record of deliberate cruelty and efforts pursued aggressively throughout the last decade to purposefully minimize the humanitarian goods that enter the country, in the face of enormous human suffering, including massive increases in child mortality and widespread epidemics. The U.S. blocked water tankers from reaching Iraq on grounds so spurious that they were rejected by the U.N. arms experts. This, during a time when the major cause of child deaths was lack of access to clean drinking water, and when the country was in the midst of a drought. Washington insisted that vaccines for infant diseases be withheld until it was compelled to back down in the face of vigorous protests by UNICEF and the World Health Organization, supported by European biological weapons experts who charged that the dual-use claims of the U.S. were flatly impossible. The International Red Cross, drawing on its own intimate familiarity with the country, concluded in 1999 that after a decade of sanctions, the Iraq economy lies in tatters, and the Oil for Food program, introduced by UN Resolution 986 in 1995, has not halted the collapse of the health system and the deterioration of water supplies, which together pose one of the gravest threats to the health and well-being of the civilian population. Aid agencies can only hope to mitigate some of the worst effects of the sanctions, and cannot nearly cover the overwhelming needs of 22 million people, the ICRC reported. Defenders of the sanctions regime argued that the appalling situation was Saddam's fault because of his refusal to comply fully with UN resolutions and his construction of palaces and monuments to himself, and so on, funded by money diverted from smuggling and other illegal operations, according to the testimony of UN humanitarian coordinators and the World Food Program. The argument then was that we had to punish Saddam for his crimes by crushing his victims and strengthening their torturer. By similar logic, if a criminal hijacks a school bus, we should blow it up and murder the passengers, but rescue and reward the hijacker, justifying the actions on grounds that it was his fault. Studied lack of interest in the likely consequences of war for the population of the country to be invaded is conventional. The same was true when, 5 days after 9/11, Washington demanded that Pakistan eliminate truck convoys that provide much of the food and other supplies to Afghanistan's civilian population, and cause the withdrawal of aid workers along with severe reduction in food supplies, thereby leaving millions of Afghans at grave risk of starvation, risk of what should properly have been termed silent genocide. Estimates of the numbers at grave risk of starvation rose from 5 million before 9/11 to 7.5 million a month later. The threat and then reality of bombing elicited sharp protests from aid organizations and warnings of what might ensue, which received only scattered and very partial attention and little reaction. Perhaps it's worth repeating the obvious. One always hopes that worst-case scenarios will not materialize, and every effort should be always dedicated to that end. But exactly as in the case of Khrushchev's dispatch of missiles to Cuba, which could have led to nuclear war but didn't, it is the range of likely possibilities that determines the evaluation of policy choices that are made, at least for those capable of entertaining elementary moral standards. Trivially, that judgment remains true whatever the outcome, a truism we understand well enough when applied to official enemies, but find much harder to apply to ourselves. Democracy and human rights. As noted, establishment critics restricted their comments regarding the attack on Iraq to the administration arguments they took to be seriously intended: disarmament, deterrence, and links to terrorism. They scarcely made reference to liberation, democratization of the Middle East, and other matters that would render irrelevant the inspections, and indeed everything that took place at the Security Council or within governmental domains. The reason, perhaps, is that they recognize that lofty rhetoric is the obligatory accompaniment of virtually any resort to force, and therefore carries no information. The rhetoric is doubly hard to take seriously in light of the display of contempt for democracy that accompanied it, not to speak of the past record and current practices. Critics are also aware that nothing has been heard from the present incumbents, with their alleged concern for Iraqi democracy, to indicate that they have any regrets for their previous support for Saddam Hussein, or others like him, still continuing. Nor have they shown any signs of contrition for having helped him develop weapons of mass destruction when he really was a serious danger. Nor has the current leadership explained when or why they abandoned their 1991 view that the best of all worlds would be an iron-fisted Iraqi junta without Saddam Hussein that would rule as Saddam did, but not make the error of judgment in August 1990 that ruined Saddam's record. At the time, the incumbent's British allies were in the opposition and therefore more free than the Thatcherites to speak out against Saddam's British-backed crimes. Their names are noteworthy by their absence from the parliamentary record of protests against these crimes, including Tony Blair, Jack Straw, Jeff Hoon, and other leading figures of New Labour. In December 2002, Jack Straw, then foreign minister, released a dossier of Saddam's crimes. It was drawn almost entirely from the period of firm US-UK support, a fact overlooked with the usual display of moral integrity. The timing and quality of the dossier raised many questions. But those aside, Straw failed to provide an explanation for his very recent conversion to skepticism about Saddam Hussein's good character and behavior. When Straw was Home Secretary in 2001, an Iraqi who fled to England after detention and torture requested asylum. Straw denied his request. The Home Office explained that Straw is aware that Iraq, and in particular the Iraqi security forces, would only convict and sentence a person in the courts with the provision of proper jurisdiction, so that you could expect to receive a fair trial under an independent and properly constituted judiciary. Straw's conversion must, then, have been rather similar to President Clinton's discovery, sometime between September 8th and September 11th, 1999, that Indonesia had done some unpleasant things in East Timor in the past 25 years, when it enjoyed decisive support from the U.S. and Britain. Attitudes toward democracy were revealed with unusual clarity during the mobilization for war in the fall of 2002, as it became necessary to deal somehow with the overwhelming popular opposition. Within the coalition of the willing, the U.S. public was at least partially controlled by the propaganda campaign unleashed in September. In Britain, the population was split roughly 50-50 on the war, but the government maintained the stance of junior partner it had accepted reluctantly after World War II, and had kept to even in the face of the contemptuous dismissal of British concerns by U.S. leaders at moments when the country's very survival was at stake. Outside the two full members of the coalition, problems were more serious. In the two major European countries, Germany and France, the official government stance corresponded to the views of the large majority of their populations, which unequivocally opposed the war. That led to bitter condemnation by Washington and many commentators. Donald Rumsfeld dismissed the offending nations as just the old Europe, of no concern because of their reluctance to toe Washington's line. The new Europe is symbolized by Italy, whose Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi, was visiting the White House. It was evidently unproblematic that a public opinion in Italy was overwhelmingly opposed to the war. The governments of old and new Europe were distinguished by a simple criterion. A government joined old Europe in its iniquity, if and only if it took the same position as the vast majority of its population and refused to follow orders from Washington. Recall that the self-appointed rulers of the world, Bush, Powell, and the rest, had declared forthrightly that they intended to carry out their war, whether or not the UN or anyone else catches up and becomes relevant. Old Europe, mired in irrelevance, did not catch up. Neither did New Europe, at least if people are part of their countries. Poll results available from Gallup International, as well as local sources for most of Europe, West, and East, showed that support for a war carried out unilaterally by America and its allies did not rise above 11% in any country. Support for a war, if mandated by the UN, ranged from 13% in Spain to 51% in the Netherlands. Particularly interesting are the eight countries whose leaders declared themselves to be the new Europe, to much acclaim for their courage and integrity. Their declaration took the form of a statement calling on the Security Council to ensure full compliance with its resolutions, without specifying the means. Their announcement threatened to isolate the Germans and the French, the press reported triumphantly, though the positions of New and Old Europe were in fact scarcely different. To ensure that Germany and France would be isolated, they were not invited to sign the bold pronouncement of New Europe, apparently for fear that they would do so, it was later quietly indicated. The standard interpretation is that the exciting and promising New Europe stood behind Washington, thus demonstrating that many Europeans supported the United States' view, even if France and Germany did not. Who were these many Europeans? Checking polls, we find that in New Europe, opposition to the United States' view was for the most part even higher than in France and Germany, particularly in Italy and Spain, which were singled out for praise for their leadership of New Europe. Happily for Washington, former communist countries too joined New Europe. Within them, support for the United States' view as defined by Powell, namely war by the coalition of the willing, without UN authorization, ranged from 4% in Macedonia to 11% in Romania. Support for a war even with a UN mandate was also very low. Latvia's former foreign minister explained that we have to salute and shout, "Yes, sir." We have to please America no matter what the cost. In brief, in journals that regard democracy as a significant value, headlines have read that old Europe in fact included the vast majority of Europeans, East and West, while new Europe consisted of a few leaders who chose to line up, ambiguously, with Washington, disregarding the overwhelming opinion of their own populations. But actual reporting was mostly scattered and oblique, depicting opposition to the war as a marketing problem for Washington. Toward the liberal end of the spectrum, Richard Holbrooke stressed the very important point that if you add up the population of the eight countries of the original New Europe, it was larger than the population of those countries not signing the letter. True enough, though something is omitted. The populations were overwhelmingly opposed to the war, mostly even more so than in those countries dismissed as old Europe. At the other extreme of the spectrum, the editors of the Wall Street Journal applauded the statement of the 8 original signers for exposing as fraudulent the conventional wisdom that France and Germany speak for all of Europe, and that all of Europe is now anti-American. The 8 honorable new European leaders showed that the views of the continent's pro-American majority weren't being heard, apart from the editorial pages of the journal, now vindicated. The editors blasted the media to their left, a rather substantial segment, which peddled as true the ridiculous idea that France and Germany spoke for Europe, when they were clearly a pitiful minority, and peddled these lies because they serve the political purposes of those, both in Europe and America, who oppose President Bush on Iraq. This conclusion does hold if we exclude Europeans from Europe, rejecting the radical left doctrine that people have some kind of role in democratic societies. Back among the liberals, Thomas Friedman suggested that France should be driven off the Security Council and replaced by India, which is just so much more serious than France these days. France, as they say in kindergarten, does not play well with others, and therefore doesn't line up against Saddam, but is caught up with its need to differentiate itself from America in an effort to be unique. To translate, the French government acted in accord with popular opinion, which was opposed to Washington's war plans. Therefore, France was in kindergarten, though the population of New Europe must still have been in nursery school, judging by polls. India, on the other hand, is serious, now that it is governed by a proto-fascist party that is handing the country's resources to foreign multinationals, while preaching an ultra-nationalist line for domestic purposes, and had just been implicated in a horrendous massacre of Muslims in Gujarat. And as Friedman has reported enthusiastically elsewhere, India has a wonderful software industry and sectors of great wealth. Uninterestingly, also hundreds of millions of people living under some of the worst conditions in the world, where the plight of women is not very different from life under the Taliban. All of this is of no concern as long as India is serious, just as life under the Taliban was of no concern as long as they were considered cooperative. Others preferred the Kagan boot stand. Berlusconi, Aznar, and other Churchillian figures who joined Washington demonstrated unparalleled political courage by keeping to their understanding of right and wrong, instead of sheepishly succumbing to the paranoid conspiratorial anti-Americanism of the vast majority of Europeans, who are driven by avarice and therefore unable to comprehend the strain of idealism that makes America tick. True, those leaders made no discernible effort to enlighten the misguided populations, whose views they disregarded while courageously lining up behind the most powerful military force in history. But perhaps they are not really duplicates of Churchill and FDR standing up to Hitler, rather of President Bush, whose moral rectitude derives from his evangelical zeal, as proven by the fact that his PR agents tell us so. There are many other illustrations. When Gerhard Schroeder dared to take the position of the overwhelming majority of German voters in the 2002 election, he was bitterly condemned for his shocking failure of leadership. One illustration of a serious problem. The government lives in fear of its voters, that Germany must overcome if it wants to be accepted in the civilized world. The case of Turkey is particularly revealing. Like others throughout the region, Turks despised Saddam Hussein but did not fear him. They also strongly opposed the war, about 90% in January 2003, when efforts were peaking to ensure that political leaders, if not their populations, would join Washington's enterprise. The government acted in accord with the will of the people. That shows that the elected government lacks democratic credentials, we learned on the day the polls were released, in a commentary by former ambassador to Turkey, Morton Abramowitz, now a distinguished senior statesman and commentator. 10 years ago, he explained, most of Turkey, like today, was against any involvement in a war with Iraq. But there was one notable exception, President Turgut Özal, a true Democrat who overrode his countrymen's pronounced preference to stay out of the Gulf War. Sadly, however, the current leadership is now following the people when it comes to participating in another Iraq war, rather than succumbing to intense pressures from Washington. Regrettably, Abramowitz sighed, for the U.S. there is no true Democrat around, as there was 10 years ago. Demonstrating still more clearly the lack of democratic credentials of the governing party, its unofficial leader, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, not only criticized Washington's rush to war, but took a step into truly forbidden territory, criticizing countries, the U.S. included, that built up their own weapons of mass destruction while trying to force others to get rid of theirs. As U.S. pressures mounted, Turkey's democracy began to improve. While popular opinion apparently turned even more strongly against the war, the government finally yielded to severe U.S. economic and other coercion, and agreed to comply with Washington's demands over overwhelming popular opposition. A Western diplomat, probably from the U.S. Embassy, told the press that he was encouraged by the decision and found it a very positive thing. Turkey correspondent Amberin Zaman added, "A war against Iraq remains deeply unpopular among the Turkish population. That is why Thursday's parliamentary session was closed to the public and balloting was secret." Headlines were stinging in their criticism of Turkey's ruling Justice and Development Party on Friday. The front page of the respected daily Radikal said the parliament ran away from the people. With near unanimity, Turks opposed Washington's orders, but it was understood that the leadership must obey, and Turkey joined New Europe. Or so it appeared. In the end, the Turks proceeded to teach a lesson in democracy to the West. Parliament finally refused to allow U.S. troops to be deployed fully in Turkey. To formulate the outcome within the conventional framework, the ground war has been hampered because Turkey did not accept its role as host of the Northern Front forces, again for political reasons. Its government was too weak in the face of anti-war feeling. The presuppositions are clear. Strong governments disregard their populations and accept the role assigned to them by the global ruler. Weak governments succumb to the will of 95% of their population. The crucial point was expressed clearly by Pentagon planner Paul Wolfowitz. He too berated the Turkish government for its misbehavior, but went on to condemn the military, who did not play the strong leadership role that we would have expected, but betrayed weakness in permitting the government to honor near unanimous public opinion. Turkey, he argued, had therefore to step up and say, "We made a mistake. Let's figure out how we can be as helpful as possible to the Americans." Wolfowitz's stand is particularly instructive because he is presented as the leading visionary in the crusade to democratize the Middle East. The pronouncements about the old and new Europe and the hysteria that often accompanied them provide some informative lessons about prevailing attitudes toward democracy among political and intellectual elites. Dislike of democracy is nothing new. For obvious reasons, it is a traditional stance of those who have a share in power and privilege. But it is rarely so starkly illuminated. That may help explain why establishment critics scarcely refer to the democratization rhetoric that accompanies the political leadership's dramatic display of contempt for democracy, evidently widely shared, to judge by commentary. Knowledgeable commentators have pointed to the uncomfortable dualism in Bush's foreign policy, with Bush the neo-Reaganite making ringing calls for a vigorous new democracy campaign in the Middle East, while policy imperatives tempt Washington to put aside its democratic scruples and seek closer ties with autocracies, as in the past, with remarkable consistency. Reviewing this dualism and the continuing support for brutal and repressive regimes, Thomas Carruthers expressed his hope that Bush would shift to the true spirit of President Ronald Reagan's foreign policy with its attempts to spread democracy. These hopes are particularly interesting because of their source. Carruthers has done some of the most careful work elucidating the true spirit of Reaganite dedication to democracy. He combines the standpoint of a scholar with that of an insider, having been a participant in the Reagan State Department's democracy enhancement projects in Latin America. He regards these programs as sincere, but a failure. Where Washington's influence was least, in the southern cone of Latin America, there was progress toward democracy, which the Reagan administration sought to impede, but finally accepted. Where Washington's influence was greatest, success was least. The reason, Carruthers explains, is that the Reaganite yearning for democracy was restricted to limited, top-down forms of democratic change that did not risk upsetting the traditional structures of power with which the United States has long been allied. Washington sought to maintain the basic order of quite undemocratic societies and to avoid populist-based change. Carruthers recognizes that there is a liberal critique of the Reaganite approach, but he rejects it because of its perennial weak spot. It offers no alternative. The option of allowing the population a meaningful voice in running their own affairs is not an alternative, not even to be dismissed. Carruthers also does not discuss the dedicated efforts during those years to undermine the threat of more meaningful democracy where it arose. The targeted populations are well aware of the nature of the democracy that is being brought to them. It has been regularly observed that the extension of formal democracy in Latin America has been accompanied by increasing disillusionment about democracy. One reason, pointed out some years ago by Argentine political scientist Attilio Boron, is that the new wave of democratization in Latin America has coincided with neoliberal economic reforms, which undermine effective democracy. The post-war Bretton Woods system was based on capital controls and relatively fixed currencies, not only in the expectation of economic benefit, as proved to be the case, but also to allow government space to carry out highly popular social democratic policies. It was understood that the kind of financial liberalization that opened the neoliberal era in the 1970s reduces the options for democratic choice, transferring decisions to the hands of a virtual Senate of investors and lenders. Governments now face a dual constituency conundrum, which pits the interests of voters against foreign currency traders and hedge fund managers who conduct a moment-to-moment referendum on the economic and financial policies of developing and developed nations alike, and the competition is highly unequal. John Maynard Keynes warned 70 years ago that nothing less than the democratic experiment in self-government was endangered by the threat of global financial market forces. The Secretary General of the Organization of American States, a strong advocate of neoliberal globalization, opened the annual session by warning that free movement of capital, the most undesirable feature of globalization, in fact its core feature, is the greatest obstacle to democratic governance, just as Keynes had warned. The fears go back to Adam Smith. His sole use of the phrase, invisible hand, in Wealth of Nations, is in a discussion of the harmful consequences of foreign investment, which England need not fear, he believed, because an invisible hand will induce investors to keep their capital at home. The same is true of other parts of the neoliberal package. Privatization, for example, reduces the arena of potential democratic choice, dramatically in the case of liberalization of services, which has evoked enormous popular opposition. Even in narrow economic terms, the privatization programs were imposed with little, if any, solid empirical evidence or theoretical grounding. Disillusionment with formal democracy has been evident in the U.S. as well, increasing through the neoliberal period. There was much clamor about the stolen election of November 2000 and surprise that the public did not seem to care very much. Likely reasons are suggested by public opinion studies, which reveal that on the eve of the election, three-quarters of the population regarded it as a game played by large contributors, party leaders, and the PR industry, which crafted candidates to say almost anything to get themselves elected. On almost all issues, citizens could not identify the stands of the candidates, as intended. Issues on which the public differs from elite opinion are generally off the agenda. Voters were directed to personal qualities, not issues. Among voters, heavily skewed toward the wealthy, those who recognize their class interests to be at stake tend to vote to protect those interests for the more reactionary of the two business parties. But the general public splits its vote in other ways, sometimes as in 2000, leading to a statistical tie. Among working people, non-economic issues such as gun ownership and religiosity were leading factors, so that people often voted against their own primary interests, apparently assuming that they had little choice. In 2000, feelings of powerlessness reached the highest level recorded, over 50%. What remains of democracy is largely the right to choose among commodities. Business leaders have long explained the need to impose on the population a philosophy of futility and lack of purpose in life, to concentrate human attention on the more superficial things that comprise much of fashionable consumption. Deluged by such propaganda from infancy, people may then accept their meaningless and subordinate lives and forget ridiculous ideas about managing their own affairs. They may abandon their fate to corporate managers and the PR industry and, in the political realm, to the self-described intelligent minorities who serve and administer power. From this perspective, conventional in elite opinion, the November 2000 elections did not reveal a flaw of U.S. democracy, but rather its triumph. And generalizing, it is fair to hail the triumph of democracy throughout the hemisphere and elsewhere, even though the populations do not see it that way. Liberation from tyranny, constructive solutions. The implausibility of the belief that Washington is suddenly concerned with democracy and human rights in Iraq or elsewhere should not prevent the wild men in the wings from persisting in their commitment to these ends and, to the extent possible, exerting influence in that direction. In the case of Iraq, there was always good reason to take seriously the conclusions of the most knowledgeable observers that a constructive solution to regime change in Iraq would be to lift the economic sanctions that have impoverished society, decimated the Iraqi middle class, and eliminated any possibility for the emergence of alternative leadership, while 12 years of sanctions have only strengthened the current regime, according to Hans von Sponeck. Furthermore, the sanctions compelled the population to depend for survival on the reigning tyranny, reducing even more the likelihood of a constructive solution. "We have sustained the regime and denied the opportunities for change," Dennis Halliday added. "I believe if the Iraqis had their economy, had their lives back, and had their way of life restored, they would take care of the form of governance that they want, that they believe is suitable to their country." Were these illusions? The historical record hardly suggests so. Again, consider the fate of the miserable tyrants supported by the current incumbents until the very end of their bloody rule, all overthrown by internal revolt. The case of Ceausescu, only one of many, is particularly instructive because of the nature of the internal tyrannies. As priorities shifted in 2002, it was claimed that those who shared responsibility for 20 years of torture of Iraqis were entitled to resort to violence to bring about democracy. Even their consistent record of support for savagery and tyranny and their hostility to democracy, demonstrated with unusual passion at that very moment, provided no reason to question the proclaimed intentions. But suspending disbelief, violence can be considered only if constructive solutions have clearly failed. Since such solutions were not even permitted in the case of Iraq, it can hardly be maintained that the stage of last resort had been reached. The conclusion holds whatever one's subjective judgments may be about the likelihood of success, all basically irrelevant. To paraphrase Lisa Marlowe, if this is to be the model for the hegemonic superpower, heaven help us all. Since the Reagan-Bush years, in fact before, Washington had supported Saddam Hussein in varying ways. After he stepped out of line in August 1990, policies and pretexts varied, but one element remained constant. The people of Iraq must not control their country. To repeat, the tyrant was permitted to suppress the 1991 uprising because, we were informed, Washington sought a military junta that would rule the country with an iron fist, and if no alternative is available, Saddam would have to do. The rebels failed because very few people outside Iraq wanted them to win, meaning Washington and its local allies, who held the strikingly unanimous view that whatever the sins of the Iraqi leader, he offered the West and the region a better hope for his country's stability than did those who have suffered his repression. It was impressive to see how uniformly all of this was suppressed in the shocked commentary and reporting on the exposure of the mass graves of the victims of Saddam's U.S.-authorized paroxysm of terror, offered as justification for the recent war on moral grounds, now that we have seen the mass graves and the true extent of Saddam's genocidal evil, all known at once in 1991, but ignored because of the imperative of stability. The uprising would have left the country in the hands of Iraqis, who might have been independent of Washington. The sanctions of the following years undercut the possibility of the kind of popular revolt that had overthrown other monsters, who were also strongly supported by the current incumbents. The U.S. sought to instigate coups by groups it controlled, but a popular rebellion would not have left the U.S. in charge. At the Azores summit in March 2003, Bush reiterated that stand, declaring that the U.S. would invade even if Saddam and his cohorts were to leave the country. The question of who should rule Iraq remains a prime issue of contention. Leading figures of the U.S.-backed opposition demanded at once that the U.N. play a vital role in post-war Iraq and rejected U.S. control of reconstruction or of the post-Saddam government. They strongly opposed U.S. hegemony over Iraq. Even Washington's chosen figures vigorously protested the plans to sideline them in favor of a U.S. occupation. There were also indications that the Shiite majority might support an Islamic Republic if given a voice, hardly to the taste of Washington and its plans for the region. There seems little reason to doubt that U.S. policymakers will attempt to follow the consistent practice elsewhere. Formal democracy is fine, but only if it obeys orders, like New Europe, or the limited top-down democracies in Latin America, run by the traditional structures of power with which the United States has long been allied. Brent Scowcroft, National Security Advisor for Bush Sr., spoke for the moderates when he observed that if there is an election in Iraq and the radicals win, we're surely not going to let them take over. Thus, if the Shiite majority has a significant voice in post-Saddam Iraq and joins others in the region in trying to improve relations with Iran, they will be radicals and treated accordingly. One can only expect the same if secular Democrats win, who prove to be radicals, unless we decide that history is bunk. The basic lines of U.S. thinking were illustrated in the organization chart of the civil administration of post-war Iraq. There were 16 boxes, each containing a name in boldface and a designation of the person's responsibility, from presidential envoy Paul Bremer at the top, answering to the Pentagon, down through the chart. 7 are generals, most of the rest are government officials, none Iraqis. At the very bottom, there is a 17th box, about one-third the size of the others, with no names, no boldface, and no functions. It reads, Iraqi Ministry Advisors. Some puzzled notice has been taken of the change in U.S. policy with regard to post-war control in Iraq. Elsewhere, Washington has been happy to transfer responsibility and cost to others, But in Iraq, it has insisted on running the show itself. There is no inconsistency. Iraq is not East Timor, Kosovo, and Afghanistan, Condoleezza Rice rightly stressed. She did not spell out the distinction. Perhaps it is too transparent. Iraq is a major prize. The others are considered basket cases. Therefore, Washington must be in charge, not the UN, not the Iraqi people. Putting aside the crucial question of who will be in charge, those concerned with the tragedy of Iraq had three basic goals. 1. Overthrowing the tyranny. 2. Ending the sanctions that were targeting the people, not the rulers. And 3. Preserving some semblance of world order. There can be no disagreement among decent people on the first two goals. Achieving them is an occasion for rejoicing, particularly for those who protested U.S. support for Saddam before his invasion of Kuwait and again immediately afterward, and opposed the sanctions regime that followed. They can therefore applaud the outcome without hypocrisy. The second goal could surely have been achieved, and possibly the first as well, without undermining the third. The Bush administration openly declared its intention to dismantle what remained of the system of world order and to control the world by force, with Iraq serving as the petri dish, as the New York Times called it, for establishing the new norms. It was that declared intention that elicited fear and often hatred throughout the world, and despair among those who are not content to live in infamy and are concerned about the likely consequences of choosing to do so. That is, of course, a choice, one that is very largely in the hands of the American people. Chapter 6. Dilemmas of Dominance. Enthusiasm about the new Europe of the former Soviet Empire is not solely based on the fact that its leadership is willing to salute and shout, "Yes, sir." More fundamental reasons were articulated as the European Union considered extension of membership to these countries. The U.S. strongly supported this move. The countries of the East are Europe's real modernizers, political commentator David Ignatius explained. They can blow apart the bureaucratism and welfare state culture that still hobble much of Europe and let free markets function the way they should, as in the U.S., where the economy relies heavily on the state sector. And the current incumbents broke post-war records in protectionism during their first tenure in office. Since the freedom-loving, technology-adapting people of the East are paid a small fraction of what workers in the West earn, Ignatius continues, they can drive all of Europe toward the realities of modern capitalism, the American model, apparently ideal by definition. The model has per capita growth rates approximately equal to Europe's and unemployment at about the same level, along with the highest rates of inequality and poverty, the highest workloads, and some of the weakest benefits and support systems in the advanced industrial world. The median male wage in 2000 was still below the 1979 level after the late 90s boomlet, though productivity was 45% higher, one sign of the sharp shift toward benefits for capital that is being accelerated more radically under George W. Bush. The potential contributions of Eastern Europe to undermining quality of life for the majority in the West was recognized immediately after the fall of the Berlin Wall. The business press was exultant about the green shoots in communism's ruins, where rising unemployment and pauperization of large sections of the industrial working class meant that people were willing to work longer hours than their pampered colleagues in the West, at 40% of the wages and with few benefits. Further green shoots include enough repression to keep working people in line and attractive state subsidies for Western investors. These market reforms would enable Europe to hammer away at high wages and corporate taxes, short working hours, labor immobility, and luxurious social programs. Europe would be able to follow the American pattern, where the decline of real wages in the Reagan years to the lowest level among the advanced industrial societies, apart from Britain, was a welcome development of transcendent importance. With communism's ruins playing something like the role of Mexico, the advantages can now be brought to Western Europe as well, driving it toward the U.S.-British model. Communism's ruins have many advantages over the regions that have been under unbroken Western domination for centuries. Those on the eastern side of the 500-year-old fault line dividing East and West, not quite that of the Cold War, but similar, enjoyed much higher standards of health and education after the East exited from its status as the West's original Third World, and they even have the right skin color. With the return of something like traditional relationships, the East can now provide other benefits, including a huge flood of easily exploited labor. The Ukraine is now reported to be replacing Southern Europe as the source of cheap labor in the West, depriving the collapsing Ukrainian economy of its most productive workers. Like their counterparts from Central America, Ukrainian emigrants send back enormous remittances, thus helping to keep what remains of the society alive. Working and living conditions are so awful that death rates are high, and perhaps 100,000 Ukrainian women are held in sexual slavery, not an unfamiliar story. It is clear enough why the de facto world government described in the business press should welcome Eastern Europe's market reforms, but for U.S. elites they have a further significance. Like independent social and economic development in the Third World, Western Europe's social market system could be a virus that might infect others, hence a form of successful defiance that must be dispatched to oblivion. The European welfare state systems could have a dangerous impact on American public opinion, as revealed by the continued popularity in the U.S. of a universal tax-based healthcare system, despite constant denigration in the media and the exclusion of the option from the electoral agenda on grounds that it is politically impossible, no matter what the public may think about it. The realities of modern capitalism, illustrated in the regions long subject to Western control, have been brought to much of Eastern Europe as its economies have been Latin Americanized. The reasons are debated, but the essential facts of the social and economic collapse are not. The demographic consequences, while uncertain in scale, provide one index. The UN Development Program estimates 10 million excess male deaths during the 1990s, approximately the toll of Stalin's purge 60 years earlier, if these figures are near accurate. Russia appears to be the first country to experience such a sharp decrease in births versus deaths, for reasons other than war, famine, or disease, David Powell writes. The demographic crisis is in part attributed to the crumbling of Russia's healthcare system under market reforms. The general collapse has been so severe that even the monstrous Stalin is remembered with some appreciation. More than half of Russians believe Stalin's role in Russian history was positive, while only a third disagreed, polls indicated in early 2003. The plans of the U.S. overseers of Iraq seem rather similar to those that were applied in Russia, and that have led to dismal outcomes elsewhere with fair consistency. On European unification, Washington's attitudes have always been complex. Like its predecessors, the Kennedy administration pressed for European unity, but with some concern that Europe might go its own way. The respected senior diplomat David Bruce was a leading advocate for European unification in the Kennedy years, but, typically, saw dangers if Europe struck off on its own, seeking to play a role independent of the United States. The guiding principles were well expressed by Henry Kissinger in his Year of Europe address in 1973. The world system, he advised, should be based on the recognition that the United States has global interests and responsibilities, while its allies have only regional interests. The U.S. must be concerned more with the overall framework of order than with the management of every regional enterprise. Europe must not pursue its own independent course, based on its Franco-German industrial and financial heartland, another reason for concern about old Europe, quite apart from the reluctance of its governments to follow Washington's commands with regard to the Iraq War. The principles remain in force, despite changing circumstances. Quite apart from their potential contributions to undermining the social market systems of Western Europe, Eastern European countries are expected to be a Trojan horse for U.S. interests, undermining any drift toward an independent role in the world. By 1973, U.S. global dominance had declined from its post-World War II peak. One measure is U.S. control of the world's wealth, which is estimated to have shrunk from roughly 50% to half of that as the world economy moved to a tripolar order with three major power centers, North America, Europe, and Japan-based Asia. These structures have since been modified further, particularly with the rise of the East Asian tigers and the entry of China into the global system as a major player. The basic concerns about the prospect of an independent Europe extend to Asia as well, in new ways. Long before World War II, the U.S. was by far the greatest economic power in the world, but not a leading actor in global management. The war changed that. Rival powers were either devastated or severely weakened, while the U.S. gained enormously. Industrial production almost quadrupled under the semi-command economy. By 1945, the U.S. had not only overwhelming economic dominance, but also a position of incomparable security. It controlled the hemisphere, the surrounding oceans, and most of the territory bordering them. U.S. planners moved quickly to organize the global system, following plans that had already been developed to satisfy the requirements of the United States in a world in which it proposed to hold unquestioned power, while limiting the sovereignty of those who might pose a challenge. The new global order was to be subordinated to the needs of the U.S. economy and subject to U.S. political control as much as possible. Imperial controls, especially the British, were to be dismantled, while Washington extended its own regional systems in Latin America and the Pacific on the principle, explained by Abe Fortas, that what was good for us was good for the world. This altruistic concern was not appreciated by the British Foreign Office. Officials recognized that Washington, guided by the economic imperialism of American business interests, is attempting to elbow us out, but could do little about it. The Minister of State at the Foreign Office commented to his cabinet colleagues that Americans believe that the United States stands for something in the world, something of which the world has need, something which the world is going to like, something, in the final analysis, which the world is going to take, whether it likes it or not. He was articulating the real-world version of Wilsonian idealism, the version that conforms to the historical record. U.S. planning at the time was sophisticated and thorough. The highest priority was to reconstruct the industrial world along lines that would satisfy the requirements of the business interests that dominate policy formation, in particular, to absorb U.S. manufacturing surpluses, overcome the dollar gap, and offer opportunities for investment. The outcomes were appreciated by the domestic beneficiaries. Reagan's Commerce Department observed that the Marshall Plan set the stage for large amounts of private U.S. direct investment in Europe, laying the groundwork for multinational corporations, MNCs. Business Week described MNCs in 1975 as the economic expression of the political framework established by post-war policymakers, in which American business prospered and expanded on overseas orders, fueled initially by the dollars of the Marshall Plan, and protected from negative developments by the umbrella of American power. Other parts of the world were assigned their functions by State Department planners. Thus, Southeast Asia was to provide resources and raw materials to the former imperial masters, crucially Britain, but also Japan, which was to be granted some sort of empire toward the South, in the phrase of George Kennan, head of the State Department's policy planning staff. Some areas were of little interest to the planners, notably Africa, which Kennan advised should be handed over to Europeans to exploit for their reconstruction. A different post-war Europe-Africa relationship comes to mind in the light of history, but does not seem to have been considered. The Middle East, in contrast, was to be taken over by the United States. In 1945, State Department officials described Saudi Arabian energy resources as a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history. The Gulf region generally was considered probably the richest economic prize in the field of foreign investment. Eisenhower later described it as the most strategically important area of the world. Britain agreed. Its planners described the resources of the region in 1947 as a vital prize for any power interested in world influence or domination. France was expelled from the Middle East by legalistic maneuvers, and Britain declined over time to junior partner. Kennan, who was farsighted, recognized that by controlling Japan's supplies of energy, primarily in the Middle East at the time, the U.S. would achieve some veto power over Japan's potential military and industrial policy, though Japanese prospects were generally disparaged at the time. The issue has been the source of continued conflict since, with regard to Europe as well, as both Europe and Japan have sought a degree of energy independence. Meanwhile, Asia was changing. A prestigious task force, reporting in 2003, described Northeast Asia as the epicenter of international commerce and technological innovation, the fastest-growing economic region in the world for much of the past two decades, by now accounting for nearly 30% of global GDP, far ahead of the United States, and also holding about half of global foreign exchange reserves. These economies also account for nearly half of global inbound foreign direct investment and are becoming an increasing source of outbound FDI flowing within East Asia and to Europe and North America, which now trade more with Northeast Asia than with each other. The region is, furthermore, an integrated one. Eastern Russia is rich in natural resources, for which the industrial centers of Northeast Asia are the natural market. Integration would be enhanced by economic unification of the two Koreas with gas pipelines passing through North Korea and extension of the Trans-Siberian Railroad on the same course. North Korea was the most dangerous and ugly member of the Axis of Evil, but lowest on the target list. Like Iran, but unlike Iraq, it failed the first of the criteria for a legitimate target. It was not defenseless. Presumably, the Pentagon is working on ways to knock out the North Korean deterrent, mass artillery aimed at Seoul and U.S. forces, which are being withdrawn out of artillery range, arousing concerns in Korea about U.S. intentions. Considered in isolation, North Korea also fails the second criterion for a target. It is one of the poorest and most miserable countries in the world. But as part of the Northeast Asia complex, it gains importance for the reasons indicated by the task force. Hence, it is not an unlikely target of attack if the technical problem of countering its deterrent can be overcome. The task force recommends that Washington seek a diplomatic solution to the current crisis. It should continue the process, begun haltingly and unevenly under Clinton, aimed at normalizing United States economic and political relations with North Korea, guaranteeing the security of a non-nuclear North Korea, promoting the reconciliation of North and South Korea, and drawing North Korea into economic engagement with its neighbors. Such interactions could accelerate economic reforms already underway in North Korea, leading in time to a diffusion of economic power that would loosen totalitarian political controls and moderate human rights abuses. These policies would conform to the regional consensus, including the North Korean dictatorship, it appears. The alternative, confrontation in the manner of Bush-Rumsfeld-Cheney grand strategy, is the road to perdition, the task force argues. The recommended alternative poses certain problems, however. As the task force describes, Northeast Asia is a rapidly developing and integrated region, which might go off on an independent course, just as continental Europe might. That raises the problem Kissinger outlined. In 1998, the National Bureau of Asian Research warned that pipelines that promote greater regional integration in Northeast Asia might exclude U.S. involvement except in a marginal way, and could accelerate a process of evolution into regional blocs. These pipelines could enhance regional stability and provide a cheap alternative to oil imported from the Middle East, Selig Harrison adds. But the United States seems uneasily wary of pipeline networks in Northeast Asia. The U.S. is aware that the countries of the region want to reduce what they find to be an increasingly uncomfortable reliance on the U.S. Or, from another point of view, the veto power the U.S. exercises by virtue of its control of Middle East oil and the sea lanes for tanker traffic. The threat of potential independence may prove an impediment to diplomatic settlement. For partially related reasons, China is regarded as a prime potential enemy by Washington hawks, and much military planning is geared to that contingency. Recent efforts to strengthen India-U.S. strategic relations are partly motivated by the same concerns, along with Washington's concerns about its control over the world's largest energy reserves in the Middle East. Washington's approach to North Korea resembles its stance on Iran and pre-invasion Iraq. In all three cases, neighboring countries had been pursuing efforts to overcome hostility and move toward integration, also attempting to lend support to reformist tendencies, or at least help lay the basis for them, and those efforts continue with regard to Iran and North Korea. The U.S. somewhat hesitantly followed a similar approach toward North Korea during the Clinton years, with partial success, but apart from that, Washington has preferred confrontation. While the reasons for that preference are not identical in the three cases, there are common threads, which become clearer in the context of the grand strategy. In the early post-war years, U.S. planners sought to fashion East and Southeast Asia into a Japan-centered system within the overall framework of order maintained by the U.S. The basic framework was outlined in the San Francisco Peace Treaty, SFPT, of 1951, which formally ended the war in Asia. Apart from the three French colonies in Indochina, the only Asian countries that accepted the SFPT were Pakistan and Ceylon, both recently freed from British rule and remote from the Asian War. India refused to attend the San Francisco conference because of the terms of the treaty, among them the U.S. insistence on retaining Okinawa as a military base, as it still does, over strong protests from Okinawans, whose voices barely register in the U.S. Truman was outraged by India's disobedience. His reaction, no less elegant than the current reaction to the disobedience of old Europe and Turkey, was that India must have consulted Uncle Joe and Mao Zedong of China. The white man got a name, not just a vulgar epithet. Partly that may be ordinary racism, or perhaps it is because Truman genuinely liked and admired old Joe, who reminded him of the Missouri boss who had launched his political career. In the late 1940s, Truman found old Joe to be a decent fellow, though a prisoner of the Politburo, who can't do what he wants to. Mao Zedong, however, was a yellow devil. These distinctions extended wartime propaganda. Nazis were evil but merited a certain respect. In the stereotype, at least, they were blonde, blue-eyed, orderly, far more appealing than the frogs, whom Truman particularly disliked, not to speak of the Wops. And they were a wholly different species from the Japs, who were vermin to be crushed, at least once they became enemies. Before that, the U.S. was ambivalent about Japanese depredations in Asia, as long as U.S. business interests were protected. the primary victims of Japanese fascism and its predecessors, China and the Japanese colonies of Korea and Formosa, now Taiwan, did not attend the San Francisco Peace Conference and were accorded no serious concern. Koreans and Chinese received no reparations from Japan, nor did the Philippines, which also did not attend the conference. Secretary of State Dulles condemned Filipinos for the emotional prejudices that kept them from grasping why they would have no relief for the torture they had endured. Initially, Japan was to pay reparations, but only to the U.S. and other colonial powers, despite the fact that the war was a Japanese war of aggression in Asia through the 1930s, and only became a U.S.-led Western war with Japan after Pearl Harbor. Japan was also to reimburse the U.S. for the costs of its occupation. For its Asian victims, Japan was to pay compensation in the form of export of Japanese manufacturing products using Southeast Asian resources, a central part of the arrangements that, in effect, reconstructed something like the new order in Asia that Japan had attempted to construct by conquest, but was now gaining under U.S. domination, so that it was unproblematic. Some Asian victims of Japanese fascism, forced laborers and prisoners of war, brought suit against Japanese corporations with subsidiaries in the U.S., the legal successors of those responsible for the crimes. On the eve of the 50th anniversary of the SFPT, their suit was dismissed by a California judge on grounds that their claims were barred by the terms of the SFPT. Relying on an amicus brief filed by the State Department in support of the accused Japanese corporations, the court ruled that the SFPT had served to sustain U.S. security interests in Asia and to support peace and stability in the region. Asia historian John Price described this judgment as one of the more abysmal moments of denial, pointing out that at least 10 million people had been killed in wars in the region while Asia was enjoying peace and stability. In May 2003, John Ashcroft's Justice Department updated the stand of Clinton's State Department, submitting an amicus brief in support of the energy giant Unocal that would roll back 20 years of judicial rulings for victims of human rights abuse, Human Rights Watch warned. The Justice Department brief goes far beyond defense of the energy corporation against charges of brutal treatment of Burmese workers, slave laborers in effect. It calls for a radical reinterpretation of the Alien Tort Claims Act, ATCA, which permits victims of serious violations of international law abroad to seek civil damages in U.S. courts against their alleged abusers who are found in the United States. The Bush administration is the first to call for reversing court decisions upholding the ATCA. It is a craven attempt to protect human rights abusers at the expense of victims, HRW Executive Director Kenneth Roth observes, particularly when the abusers are energy corporations, a cynic might add. The tripolar order that was taking shape from the early 1970s has since become more firm, and with it, the concern of U.S. planners that not only Europe, but also Asia might seek a more independent course. From a longer historical perspective, that would not be too surprising. In the 18th century, China and India were major commercial and industrial centers. East Asia was far ahead of Europe in public health and probably sophistication of market systems. Life expectancy in Japan may have been higher than in Europe. England was trying to catch up in textiles and other manufacturers, borrowing from India in ways that are now called piracy and are banned in international trade agreements imposed by the rich states under a cynical pretense of free trade. The U.S. relied heavily on the same mechanisms, as have other states that have developed. As late as the mid-19th century, British observers claimed that Indian iron was as good as or better than British iron, and much cheaper. Colonization and forced liberalization converted India to a British dependency. It only resumed its growth and ended murderous famines after independence. China was not subjugated until the Second British Opium War 150 years ago, and also only resumed development after independence. Japan was the only part of Asia to resist colonization successfully, and the only one to develop, along with its colonies. It is not, then, a great surprise that Asia is returning to a position of considerable wealth and power after regaining sovereignty. These long-term historical processes, however, extend the problems of sustaining the overall framework of order in which others must respect their proper place. The problems are not restricted to successful defiance in the Third World, a major theme of the Cold War years, but reach the industrial heartlands themselves. Violence is a powerful instrument of control, as history demonstrates, but the dilemmas of dominance are not slight. Chapter 7. Cauldron of Animosities. Let us return to Michael Crepin's belief that the final days of 2002 might be the most dangerous time since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. His primary concern was the unstable nuclear proliferation belt stretching from Pyongyang to Baghdad, including Iran, Iraq, North Korea, and the Indian subcontinent. Similar concerns, widely held, were heightened by Bush administration initiatives of 2002 and 2003 that were seriously increasing international tensions and threats. There is a far more fearsome nuclear power nearby, rarely featured in public discussion in the U.S. because it is an appendage of U.S. power. That convention is not observed within the unstable belt itself, or even within the U.S. Strategic Command, or STRATCOM, which is responsible for the nuclear arsenal. General Lee Butler, Commander-in-Chief of STRATCOM from 1992 to 1994, observed that it is dangerous in the extreme that in the cauldron of animosities that we call the Middle East, one nation has armed itself ostensibly with stockpiles of nuclear weapons, perhaps numbering in the hundreds, and that it inspires other nations to do so. Israel's WMD are of concern to the world's second leading nuclear power as well. Similar concerns were expressed, more obliquely, in Security Council Resolution 687, which was selectively invoked by the Bush and Blair administrations in their efforts to provide a quasi-legal basis for their invasion of Iraq. Neither that nor any other resolution grants such authorization, but 687 did call for elimination of Iraqi WMD and delivery systems as a step toward the goal of establishing in the Middle East a zone free from weapons of mass destruction and all missiles for their delivery, from Article 14. U.S. intelligence and other sources assume that Israel has several hundred nuclear weapons and has been developing chemical and biological weapons. Article 14 is commonly ignored in U.S. commentary, but not elsewhere. Iraq, for example, called on the Security Council to apply Article 14. Its motives do not obviate the importance of the issue. General Butler's concerns are not trivial. Undoubtedly, Israeli military power will continue to inspire other nations to develop WMD, including quite possibly even Iraq, if it is granted a modicum of independence. The issue addressed by Article 14 had arisen before, on the eve of the First Gulf War. After invading Kuwait in August 1990, Iraq made a number of proposals for withdrawal within the context of a broader regional settlement. These were leaked to the press by U.S. government officials who found them serious and negotiable. How serious they were, we cannot judge. The U.S. immediately dismissed them, according to the only journalist in the country who reported the matter carefully, Nutt Royce of Newsday. It is of some interest that in the final polls before the bombing, two-thirds of the American public favored a conference on the Israel-Arab conflict if it would lead to Iraqi withdrawal. Doubtless, those figures would have been higher if the public had known that Iraq had just made a similar proposal, dismissed by Washington. A devastating war and even more destructive aftermath might have been prevented, hundreds of thousands of lives saved, and perhaps a basis laid for the overthrow of Saddam's tyranny. It is possible that steps might have been taken toward elimination of WMD and delivery systems in the region and beyond, perhaps even extending to the great powers, for 30 years in violation of their commitment under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to take good faith steps toward eliminating nuclear weapons, matters of no slight significance. Well beyond WMD, Israel's military capacities are regarded in the region as dangerous in the extreme. Though a very small country, Israel has chosen to become, in effect, an offshore U.S. military and technology base, and as such has been able to develop highly advanced military forces. The core of the economy is a military-linked high-tech industrial system with close ties to the U.S. economy. Not surprisingly, Israel is coming to resemble its patron in other ways as well. A parliamentary, or Knesset, investigation found that Israel is now rated second in the Western world after the United States, in terms of social gaps in income, property, capital, education, and spending, as well as in the extent of poverty. Its formerly quite successful social welfare system has eroded, and social-cultural values have changed significantly as well. Like its patron, Israel has military forces that are off the spectrum of societies comparable in other dimensions. The head of research and development for the Israel Defense Forces, or IDF, described its air and armored forces as larger and technologically more advanced than those of any NATO power apart from the U.S. Its conventional military forces are used to attack its neighbors and to control and subjugate the population in the territories it occupies, in ways not easily overlooked in the region or by people elsewhere who are concerned with human rights.